Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
In the drawing room, a group of suspects gathered. The detective has solved the mystery.
Ladies and gentlemen, the butler did it.
You'll never catch me.
The butler darted to his getaway car. But what he didn't know is this is a Nissan sales event ad.
Wait, what?
And his car is no match for the detective's Nissan Rogue or its standard VC turbo engine. Save on one of your own at the Nissan Thrill of the Drive sales event.
Now get 0% APR financing for 36 months on select models. Availability is limited. For well-qualified buyers, 0% APR financing for 36 months available on new 2023 Altima, Rogue, and Pathfinder when financed through NMAC. Must take delivery from new dealer stock. 36 months financing at $2,778 per month per 1,000 financed. Actual down payment may vary, subject to residency restrictions and NMAC credit approval. Not all buyers qualified. Dealer contribution may affect actual price set by dealer. Contact dealer for details. Offer ends 2/28/23.
What happened to music that meant something?
The Who at the Kingdom or Kiss at the Coliseum. Where is the Misty Mountain Hop? Where is the smoke on the water? Where is the Iron Man of today?
Hey, this is not a test. This is rock and roll.
Welcome to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. I'm Jim DeRogatis, the pop music critic at the Chicago Sun-Times.
And I'm Greg Kot. I write about rock and roll for the Chicago Tribune. Today on the world's only rock and roll talk show, Jim and I welcome folk punk singer Ani DeFranco for a conversation and acoustic performance.
And later on, we'll review Bob Dylan's new holiday release, and it'll be Greg's turn to add a quarter to the Desert Island Jukebox.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and now it's time for some music news.
Yes, Mr. Kot, somebody is watching you. That song creeps me out. Even creepier, though, is the notion that many people in many different segments of society would like government to keep a much closer watch on everything you, I, and everyone else does on the net. Correct me if I'm wrong, but this was a central theme of the big Future of Music Policy Summit in Washington, D.C., which you covered for the paper.
Indeed, Jim, it was. And I think this whole issue of net neutrality, people have probably heard that term bandied around a little bit. What it basically means is it's the principle that keeps the net equally accessible to all users. There are some forces out there, big corporations, for example, that would like a tiered system of access. In other words, if the more you can pay, the cleaner and quicker pipeline you have to accessing the net and getting out to your users. A couple of speakers, prominent speakers at the Future of Music Policy Summit addressing this issue. And I think it really gave me chills, actually, to hear them speak, because I was wondering, even though they came out strongly in favor of net neutrality, there was a part B to both of their speeches that gave me pause. As I said, prominent speakers, Senator Al Franken, the newly elected senator from Minnesota, speaking on behalf of net neutrality, and a very powerful inside player in Washington, the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, Julius Genachowski, coming out strongly in favor of net neutrality as well. But both Franken and Genachowski both said while they're in favor of this democratic principle that the internet should be equally accessible to everybody, they both said that the enforcement of copyright and laws of network openness can and must coexist. Now, it's interesting. I think everybody agrees, hey, artists need to get paid for the music they make. However, is the idea that anybody can access the net compatible with the idea of tracking down somebody who is, quote-unquote, illegally trading music files on the internet?
Well, it's fascinating to me that Franken played a role in that because, of course, he was a comedian and a writer and a broadcaster. He's someone whose old videos, as Stuart Smalley on Saturday Night Live, may be all over YouTube, right? He's written books. Rush Limbaugh's a big fat liar. So he owns copyrights, and maybe that gives him sensitivity about artists getting paid?
Yeah, I mean, Franken actually brought that up in his speech and said, you know, I'm an artist too, I want to get paid. The problem here is that it's very difficult in the peer-to-peer file trading world to determine whether a file that's being traded is illegal or legal under present copyright law. There would have to be a police system in place that may not be compatible with this idea of net neutrality. It'd be interesting to see how they can reconcile those two impulses. Already in Europe, we've talked about this on the show before, Jim, countries like France and Sweden are essentially invading the privacy of users, saying, you know, if you do this sort of activity, we're going to cut you off from the internet. Is this kind of system going to become in place in the United States if these net neutrality laws are put in place with these sort of caveats attached? It remains to be seen. I think it's going to be one of the most fascinating and contentious debates in Washington over the next couple of years.
Motions giving moonlight meaning I've never known this kind of love. This kind of love.
That is a song called This Kind of Love, which is the title track of Carly Simon's last album, released in 2008, kind of a Brazilian-tinged singer-songwriter effort by the woman who most famously gave us You're So Vain and other hits like that. Greg, it's interesting to us because it is the last piece of a story we covered from beginning, middle to end. You know, one of the things that was looking as if it might be a viable alternative for artists, established artists, to sell their music was to get in bed with Starbucks. You know, the coffee chain started a record label, Hear Music, signed some of the biggest names in music history, Paul McCartney, right? Mm-hmm. And was selling several releases exclusively through its stores. Carly Simon made a deal with them, was supposed to be paid $750,000 as an advance, recorded an album, and was not happy at all about the way Hear Music sold it and failed to deliver, she said, on promises it made, and then went out of business shortly after her album was supposed to be out there getting pushed. She is suing Starbucks now for damages, substantial damages, as a high-powered lawyer, David Boies. He's the man who sued Microsoft. You know, what a tawdry way for this idea to end, as Starbucks as an alternative music company.
Well, it's interesting because the company had success with McCartney's Memory Almost Full record. He was very pleased with the marketing campaign behind that. The fact that he sold over 500,000 copies of that record. Earlier, they'd had a lot of success selling Ray Charles records. But then they signed artists like James Taylor and Joni Mitchell and Carly Simon, and those sales didn't go nearly as well. And this idea of turning Starbucks into this sort of diversified store for coffee drinkers really didn't pan out, and they didn't give it much of a chance. I have to say, after a couple of years, they ended this idea, and people like Carly Simon are royally ticked at them right now.
Between you and your ambition, I am a poster girl with no poster. I am 32 flavors and then some, and I'm beyond your peripheral vision. So you might want to turn your head, cause someday you are gonna get hungry and eat most of the words you just said.
You're listening to Sound Opinions. That is 32 flavors from Ani DeFranco, one of the leading independent artists of the last 20 years, truly an independent artist, in a lot of ways setting the template for the peer-to-peer file-sharing world we live in now, where the artist-to-fan communication is paramount. Ani was doing that 20 years ago, basically, when she started her own record label in Buffalo, New York, Righteous Babe Records, as an outlet for her own music, using it as a forum to put out her recorded music, jumping into a beat-up car with her guitar and playing for anyone who would have her around the country, slowly building that touring base, putting out a record a year, now to the point where she can sell out shows at auditoriums of 4,000 to 5,000 people. A lot of artists we talk to today, Jim, turn to us and say, you know, I want to do it like Ani DeFranco did. Yeah. I want to own all my own master tapes. I want to run my own label. I don't want the man telling me what I can or can't do. I want to have that communication base that she has direct to fan.
Greg, Ani is slowing down slightly these days. She is now happily married and raising her daughter, but she's still running Righteous Babe. She was on tour. She was here in Chicago, and we had her by the studio for a chat and a live performance.
You're listening to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot. He's Jim DeRogatis, and we're here in the studio with Ani DeFranco. Ani, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Hi.
It's great to have you here.
It's nice to be here.
You're sitting here with an acoustic guitar, unaccompanied otherwise, and it's giving me flashbacks of seeing you perform in the early 90s.
Oh, lordy.
Back at that time. Pretty much the same
were
picture.
Were we ever so young?
Yeah. I think your haircut was a little different back then.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
But otherwise, pretty much the same kind of scenario. And you had already started your own label. Mm-hmm. You had already put out records at that point. You were touring the country basically on your own. At 19 years old, you started your label, started putting out records the next year. You were a woman on a mission.
Yeah.
What was going on in your life that in 1989 you said, I'm going to do this on my own?
Mm-hmm. You know, I sort of got started early in life in general. I was living on my own when I was 15 and paying rent and, you know, passing in the adult world. So I had a little bit of that experience under my belt and had already formed a few opinions about things like corporate America and my aversion to it, you know. So when I started recording records and selling them at my gig and starting the concept of what became Righteous Babe Records, my own label, it was not that I had a horror story that I had been messed around by a label or had any bad experiences. It was that I didn't want to be a part of that world, you know, just to have a career in music. So I was just making it up as I went along.
It's pretty fascinating, though. I mean, and this is Buffalo, New York, upstate New York, a part of the country.
Center of the universe.
Very familiar with. That's not necessarily a center of culture. Mm-hmm. What happened to you in those years that you were thinking along these lines?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I don't know that it's the most cosmopolitan city out there. It's a little Rust Belt town, you know, kind of evacuated. But there is a lot of Buffalo in me. A lot of Buffalo informs, I think, my outlook. You know, I'm just a real kind of down-to-earth gal, sort of unpretentious in my approach to music and performance. You know, I just kind of walk up on stage and say whatever's on my mind, for better or worse. And that kind of carries over into my, you know, big business strategy, too, you know? Just stick with it. Work your butt off. Play gigs every night, anywhere you can get them, for about 10 years, and then see what happens, if you know.
Mm-hmm. I keep quoting you every time people talk about, you know, what do I need to do to, you know, and you come up constantly as sort of a role model. I want to own everything. I want to do it on my own. I turned that question back on you years ago, and you said one word, patience.
Yeah, I think I've grown my patience, you know, as I got older. But I think what I did have in the beginning was just a lust for what I did, for making music, you know. And it was so exciting to me to play in a bar for five people, just especially if I could see their eyes and smell them. And, you know, that kind of making that connection was always very exciting to me. So I wasn't sort of holding out for the rock star dream or waiting to be happy or fulfilled with my art. You know, I think what passed for patience in the beginning was just sincerely being thrilled by whatever kind of performance or low, you know, obscure situation I was in.
Mm-hmm. Well, you made reference to this being precocious and starting young, but is this a true story or is this one of those apocryphal things that you were out there playing and getting paid to perform busking at age 9?
Yep. Mm-hmm. I was making money for summer camp at the time. I really wanted to go to camp. And so I was making money any way I could. And one of the ways was to set up at the market every Saturday and on the street, 9 years old, doing that. And then actually, when I was a teenager, I was working in bars. Mm-hmm. I had some arrangements with some local Buffalo pubs and stuff. You know, I ran open mics. You know, I wasn't drinking. I was just
working. When you're underage, they always tell you, you know, just say you wandered in accidentally from the restaurant, right?
Yeah, now I imagine it's even harder, you know, to go and play music or see music in a place with alcohol because it's so locked down. But those days, it was a little looser.
But basically, you just weren't going to take anybody's answer that you couldn't make this a career.
Yeah, sure enough. Yeah, for me, people always, whatever, the word successful or something, they seem to have this kind of pie-in-the-sky definition for it. Like, successful means you're on TV, on MTV or something now. And for me, successful was I play music, I feed myself, right. I pay my rent.
I don't have to work,
yeah,
quote,
I was
unquote.
Successful when I was 18 and playing music for a living, so to speak.
But I think what Greg was getting at is what were your models for that, Ani? You know, I mean, you're growing up in D.C., you look at Fugazi. It's mm-hmm, obvious. You know, mm-hmm, growing up in Chicago, you can look at, you know, Steve Albini created himself a niche outside the corporate world. Mm-hmm. Were you looking at anybody?
Well, sure. You know, in the folk music world, there's a whole national underground, international, really, of song people. Pretty early on, I tapped into that community, and it made all the difference in the world for me. I started playing at folk festivals when I was a teenager, and that exposed me to a huge supportive audience that got me working sooner rather than later. And also, there were many precedents for being independent. You know, lots of little labels, lots of people who infuse their music with a lot of politics and community and music as a social act and a organizational tool and all of that. You know, that was all around me.
Well, you want to play us a song before we, because we could just
sure.
chat all day.
Yeah. Let me see. Maybe I'll play you a rant as my folk singing and somewhat mentor friend Utah Phillips would call it. This one goes out to him. I will not stand immersed in this ultra-violent curse. I won't let you make a tool of me. I will keep my mind and body free. Bye-bye, minutia of the day-to-day drama. I'm expanding exponentially. I am consciousness without identity. I am many things made of everything, but I will not be your bankroll. I won't idle in your drive-thru. I won't watch your electric sideshow. I got way better places to go. I will maintain the truth I knew naturally as a child. I won't forfeit my creativity to a world that's all laid out for me. I'll look at everything around me, and I will vow to bear in mind that all of this was just someone's idea. It could just as well be mine. I won't rent you my time. I won't sell you my brain. I won't pray to a male god, because you know that would be insane. And you know I can't support the troops, cause every last one of them is being duped, yeah. And I will not rest a wink until women have regrouped. I have many things made of everything, but I will not be your bankroll. I won't idle in your drive-thru. I won't watch your electric sideshow. I got way better places to go.
Wow.
I love a good rant.
That's,
And furthermore.
That is a heck of a song. People who say protest songs aren't being written anymore, that was All of This from the latest Ani DiFranco studio record called Red Letter Year. Boy, you know, when I listen to a song like that, people are talking about this is the happy Ani record.
Yeah, I know, I've heard
and
that
then
too.
Then there's that song.
Yeah, right? And others, super capital P political stuff on that new record. But
yeah.
It's really my fault. We put out the press release for that record, and it said, Ani's happy, and it's a happy, happy Ani happy, the happy record.
Yeah.
So people picked up on the H word.
Right.
For sure.
Now, well, that doesn't preclude that you know, I'm happiest when I'm ranting.
Amen. There you go.
Right.
We'll continue our conversation with singer, songwriter, and ranter Ani DiFranco after a short break on Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. And later on, Dylan Does Christmas.
Just call me shameless. I can't even slow this down, let alone stop this. And I keep looking around, but I cannot top this. If I had any sense, I guess I'd fear this. I guess I'd keep it down so no one would hear this. I guess I'd shut my mouth and rethink a minute. But I can't shut it now, cause there's something in it. We're in a room without a door, and I am sure without a doubt they're gonna wanna know how we got in here, and they're gonna wanna know how we plan to get out. And we better have a good explanation for all the fun that we had. Yes.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. I'm Greg Kot with Jim DeRogatis, and you're listening to our conversation with musician Ani DiFranco. That was a little bit of Red Letter Year, the title song from her new album, and the record, like much of her work, is very political. She's speaking out against racism, sexism, homophobia, just to name a few issues. And so I asked Ani if she ever worried about being so outspoken. Has there ever been a moment in your life as a songwriter that you felt, you know what, I am putting too much, this is going to get misinterpreted, especially as a young woman touring the country by yourself, essentially. You could end up in some venues in some parts of the country where stuff like that isn't going to go over too
we've
well.
We've asked Steve Earle this question, you know, but he, you know, before Atkins, he was big and burly, and he could probably take most covers.
Yeah, you know, last night, I was playing, I stepped out on stage, and in the front row was very many older people, elderly people. I don't know what, if it was season ticket scenario or how they ended up at my show, but I was like, whoa. Looking at my set list, like, oh, okay. Here we go. And it was great. It was terrific. I love playing to different kinds of people. And in the early days, when I was a teenager and just starting to write songs, I had many moments of fear. You know, can I say this? Can I say that? And, oh, what if my mom comes to the show and such? And then my experience took over. You know, I powered through those moments of fear early on. And overwhelmingly over the years, what happens when you put yourself out there like that, your opinions, your perceptions, your experiences, is so many more people come up and say, me too. Oh my goodness, thank you for saying that. Then say, shut up, go away, we can't take it, you know.
In terms of the progression, you know, unless we're talking about performances here, those early shows where you're playing to strangers and you're trying to win that audience over, and then there was a progression where people were paying to see you, and they were coming by, there's roughly 800,000 people coming to see you, and those shows, I mean, it was amazing, because you're up there just with that acoustic guitar, and you could hear a pin drop in there. I mean, it was just this reverential kind of hanging on every word vibe. And then, you know, seeing you progress to the 4,000 capacity theaters where people can be drinking a beer and having a conversation while you're singing. How did you sort of adapt to the fact that, you know, I am this bigger, more mainstream personality almost in spite of the way I've operated? And yet you have this different kind of audience. How do you how do you feel about that?
Well, there was a little time period in there, probably late 90s, where I probably hit my peak of notoriety. You know, I was on the covers of whatever magazines, and and I was this overnight success after, good
15 years.
Yeah, totally. And at that point, you know, the shows, I was sort of playing some arenas type venues, and the capacities got to 9,000, 10,000 for a minute there. That was not great for me. You know, it's not good for doing subtle things, for connecting in intimate ways. You know, stadium rock sounds like and works like stadium rock for a reason, you know. So to play to a room like that was sort of antithetical to my art. As I got back down to the smaller theaters, I started to be able to do what I do better. But I really, luckily, I did feel ready for all of those stages. The frantic, exponential growth of my audience, and also the what I'm still in, you know, the slow retraction and decline, you know, back to sort of more of an essential core audience, not the what is this famous person about, peripheral people. But it was that 20 years of playing in bars that's why when young people come to me and say, how do I get on the bus with the curtains in the window and the big TV and the, you know, I think, don't even, just how do you get the next gig and the next gig and the next gig?
They always ask the wrong question. They want to ask about the tour and the bus. And it's should be asking me, how do I fill 200 people in this club?
Yeah. And all of that honing of your craft that is very unglamorous, as the years go by, is very, very useful, essential in the end.
Mm-hmm. Is the touring, I mean, that is so much a part of the folk tradition. Is that something you can envision yourself doing? But you're now a mom, you're married, you know, you've got this other life going on. Is it something that you even want to do as you move forward in your life?
I usually shy away from predicting the future, because if I know anything, it's change happens. But I can pretty solidly say I want to do this. I want to be Pete Seeger, 90 years old, rocking it. I think I'm going to need to develop a different pace. You know, I've been pretty frantic most of my career, and now, like you say, I got a family and I got reasons to stay home. So I'm going to just need to pace myself a little bit. But it's still really there's nothing like it for me, being out there, being connected with people. You know, having conversations with people in places, and I really would not be the artist I am without it.
Could you, at this point, just sustain yourself on recorded music?
I think it's really much harder now for, like you say, if you're not out there playing. I mean, again, that's my model, and that's what I tell everybody, even though they don't want to hear it. You know, the whole infrastructure of the indie record stores and the indie radio and indie, the whole community, all the indie labels, like, that's just crumbled. So that's really tough. I think that what most artists are doing these days is advertisement, you know. And I'm not well for that myself. I sort of drew that line in the sand a long time ago and decided I wasn't going to allow any of my music to be used in advertisement. So it's been really hard for me lately, because that's what people do other than movie and TV placement.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're here in performance mode. How about another song?
Sure. Let's see.
Tell us what you're going to do.
What am I going to do? I'm going to play a song off that last record as well. It's one I wrote after the birth of my daughter a few years ago.
Who's what, 2.5 now?
She's 2.5, mm-hmm.
been glaring into mirrors, picking myself apart. You'd think at my age I thought of something better to do than make insecurity into a full-time job, make insecurity into an art. And I fear my life will be over and I will have never lived it unfettered, always glaring in the mirrors, mad I don't look better. But now here's this tiny baby, and they say she looks just like me, and she is smiling at me with that present infant glee. Yes, and I would defend to the ends of the earth her perfect right to be. Problems with the ongoing work of my mind, and I've got myself a new mantra. It says, don't forget to have a good time, don't let the sellers of stuff power enough to rob you of your grace. Love is all over the place, there's nothing wrong with your face. Love is all over the place, there's nothing wrong with your face.
Present infant from Ani DeFranco.
You're good. You're good.
I'm good.
I'm not
he's got
even...
the, he's got
great
the
song.
CD
I got my cheat sheet here.
Oh, yeah, go.
But good stuff. And mother's advice to her daughter. You know, it's interesting. Just hearing you play that song, I'm thinking back to those songs that you were writing when you were first starting out. And it almost seems like that's the kind of advice, or you wish somebody had said that to you when you were younger. Any truth to that?
Yeah. A lot of what I write, most of what I write, I'm just writing to myself, really. And in that way, I've written myself into being, you know, and I think a message that sort of comes through my words over and over in different songs in different ways is become yourself, trust yourself, love yourself, you know, respect yourself. And not only come up with your own answers, come up with your own questions. You know? And so in that way, it's I'd like to think that my message is never do as I do or think as I think, but think as you think. Make sure you're thinking as you think.
As far as I'm concerned, the essential message of all great art. There was a scare where you had tendonitis for a while. Yeah. It came on in, what, 2007, right?
Yeah, something like that.
I mean, because it has seemed as if you regularly played a city like Chicago two or three times a year,
right.
Every year, yeah. From the beginning. Were you worried that you wouldn't be able to, because that's got to be a huge part of your income at this point.
Yes, yes, more and more as the record industry implodes around us. Touring is my bread and butter, and very scary. It was horrible to be playing in pain every night and to be, you know, taking songs off the set list that I just can't play and to just be trying to get through an hour and a half and then going and plunging my arms into ice. And, you know, it was a real gauntlet for a while, and then I had to stop. And for me, stopping means a lot of people lose their job, you know?
Yeah.
It's sort of a subliminal pressure, you know, when so many people's livelihoods are...
Because you're talking about your crew. You got a crew.
My crew, and even back at the home office, you know, the label. If I'm not touring, you know, everything slows down. And
right.
So that was a tough decision, and I stayed home for 9 months. I just didn't play guitar. And I thought I would heal. Mm. And then I went back to work 9 months later and realized, no, tendonitis is serious stuff, as all of us monkeys in the modern world know now with our computers and our gizmos, and it's affecting
so
many of
us. She said fading the typing, Greg and I do, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, so many of us know what tendonitis is about.
But you're not wearing a brace.
I'm not now.
And you're on the road.
Yep, so I'm back, and I'll tell you one word that really turned the corner for me, acupuncture.
Mm-hmm.
Huge. Really has helped me a lot.
Well, it's great they found a solution, because I think we need to talk about your guitar playing. You know, you're a shredder, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you could be, you're a cooler Yngwie Malmsteen, you know, in your own way. I mean, but you're an acoustic, and you play quote-unquote folk music, and therefore you're never in that discussion about great guitar players. You know, it was always like, man, have you seen this person play guitar? It was like, when I first saw you play, it was like, I'm hearing two or three guitar players. What motivated you, first of all, to pick up a guitar? And then how did you learn to play as you do?
I think it was sort of an intuitive choice when I was nine. I wanted to write songs, and, you know, a guitar is a very good instrument to accompany the voice. And I think that my sort of style was really kind of honed almost as a survival skill. Years of playing solo in a bar where nobody's really interested in the little girl in the corner pouring her heart out. You know, everybody's got their business to take care of. So, you know, all of that, like, you know, over here, juxtaposing loud with silence makes somebody's talking over you. Suddenly their words are hanging in the air and they shut up. And, you know, all of that kind of percussive, be your own band, attract attention kind of guitar style. I think I honed in bars over the years.
Born out of necessity, like the great blues players who learned to innovate. You know, there was a beer bottle there. I'm going to put it against the guitar. There's a slide.
Yeah.
Do you want to play another tune for us?
Sure. Let me play you a brand new song. Well,
workshopping.
Yeah, there you go. Brand new as in written on November 5th of 2008. The victory was ours, and you were the first to say it. Never known so many people donate time to a campaign. And when you were elected, there was a global wave of joy. Who knew a world gone mad could still go sane? And we poured into the streets, and we danced, and we cheered. And the neighborhood was a neighborhood like it hadn't been in years. All eyes meeting, filled with tears. Guess we prayed you were coming, and then we saw you were here. You are black, you are white. You are red, you are blue. You are green and orange with a purple and yellow hue. You've risen like a phoenix from each flame that they threw. You've been everything that we asked of you. Oh, President Obama, it's an honor just to say it. I used to hide my passport, now I want to display it. Thank you for our democracy, through you is resurrected. Thank you for our basic decency, in you is reflected. Thank you, America, for being more than I expected. Oh, yes, we can. 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 Oh, yes, we can. 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 Oh, yes, we can. President Obama, you do not have to be perfect. I trust that you are a public servant, steady as Abraham Lincoln, ready as Martin Luther King. That's the spirit that you bring. And we vow to uphold you through these tricky times, keep you safe in our hearts and informed with our minds. And we will uphold each other. We won't divide and attack. There is no going back. There is no going back. Yes, we can. Yes, we can. Yes, we can. Yes, we can. Oh, yes, we can. 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 Yes, we can.
victory was ours, and you were the first to say it.
Wow. Great stuff. Yes, We Can. Is that the name of it?
It's called November 5th, 2008.
November 5th, 2008, the day it was written.
Yeah.
Ani, thank you for coming on Sound Opinions. It's been a complete pleasure.
Thank you. Likewise.
To listen to Ani's entire live performance in our studio, visit soundopinions.org. And to comment on our conversation or share any of your critical opinions on the air, call our hotline, 888-859-1800. We're going to be back in a minute on Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media with our review of the new holiday album from Bob Dylan and my Desert Island Jukebox pick.
Summon the courage to put down your landing gear and come out here. Because I am as exhausted as I drown in polar bear, swimming around looking for a ride. And it's so good. Sweeping his hand through the air like Mr. Showbiz. You're gonna love this world if it's the last thing I do. The whole extravagant joke tucked in bittersweet chocolate goo. For someone who ain't even here yet, look how much the world loves you. The world loves you.
Here comes Santa Claus, here comes Santa Claus, right down Santa Claus Lane. Fixing and blixing and holding his reindeer, pulling on the reins. Bells are ringing, children singing, all is merry and bright.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. Mr. Cott and I are smiling widely because that voice can only belong to one person on planet Earth. That, of course, is Bob Dylan. Yeah, you heard it right. Santa Claus Comes Tonight. Santa Claus Comes to Town. It's from his new Christmas album, Christmas in the Heart. Greg, after 34 studio albums, countless tours, unbelievable live documents of 50 years on the road, basically, you would think there is very little that Robert Allen Zimmerman of Duluth, Minnesota, could do to surprise anyone anymore. He just found something, okay? I want to point out something about Bob Dylan, which is one of my favorite things about an artist I love and have been studying essentially my entire music listening life. He has a warped and twisted, bizarre and surrealistic sense of humor. We talked at great length when he wrote the first volume of his autobiography, which has amazing chestnuts like him saying the biggest artistic inspirations in his life were the old-time wrestler Gorgeous George and ukulele strumming Tiny Tim. When you understand that Dylan just likes to crack wise and really play with his image as the self-important voice of a generation,
right,
you begin to understand things like Dylan popping up in a Victoria's Secret commercial a few years ago. I give you that for context because no one expected him to go into the studio with his touring band and a few close friends like David Hidalgo, the accordion player from Los Lobos, who really was the star of Dylan's last studio album, and turn out a collection of mostly holiday chestnuts, the most tried and true of Christmas songs. You know, I'm talking Hark the Herald Angels Sing and Little Drummer Boy. What is this about? Well, all the money from copies of this record that are being sold are going to be donated to charities devoted to easing world hunger. A noble idea. But we are going to have to review this as critics, as art. So I'm going to play a song for you, and we'll come back and give our opinions about Dylan's new Christmas in the Heart. This is O Come All Ye Faithful, a.k.a. Adeste Fidelis, with one of the most fascinating Latin pronunciations I've ever heard. By Bob Dylan on Sound Opinions.
Adeste fidelis, leite triumphantes, venite, venite, tempest. Venite adoremus, venite adoremus, venite adoremus, Dominum. Oh, come all ye faithful, joyful and triumphant. Oh come ye to Bethlehem. Come and behold him, born the King of angels. Oh come, let us adore.
Oh, come all ye faithful. Yes, that was Bob Dylan. The first ever Bob Dylan Christmas album, Christmas in the Heart. Wow. You know, I want to preface all my remarks, Jim, by just declaring yet again that I think Bob Dylan is the most important artist of the last 50 years.
I will concur, yes.
You know, what Picasso was to painting, Bob Dylan is to rock and roll.
An American living treasure.
Absolutely. And everything he puts out is at least worth hearing, at least paying attention to.
However,
at the risk of sounding like Ebenezer Cott,
yeah.
The Grinch who stole Christmas, I got to say, and noble charities. I mean, three charities, all the profits from this record, Bob's heart was in the right place. However, the execution of this record is abysmal. This is a travesty in a lot of ways. I can't begin to think why Dylan, in making a Christmas album, would want to make a Christmas record modeled after one of those that the Ray Conniff Singers made.
Yeah.
Back in my grandparents' record collection.
Or the King Family Singers. Remember them? The King Show on Christmas,
yeah,
every year?
It reminds me of that kind of, you know, style of crooning. Obviously, Dylan is not a crooner, never really was. He's attempting to croon these traditional Christmas ballads, being propped up by these middle-brow choirs in the middle of these songs. It is almost a parody, like he's almost tongue-in-cheek about it. As you said, he has a well-earned reputation for subtle satire in some of his music, and I'm wondering if there's a bit of this in that, or if this is just a sort of a misguided attempt to do a traditional Christmas album, because that's what he thinks the audience that is buying a charity album expects.
The last three albums by Dylan that you and I have reviewed, we have been fighting, because he does have this fondness for the schlockiest kind of late 40s, early 50s, pre-rock and roll, mainstream pop.
Right.
I'm talking like, how much is that doggy in the window? He likes that. He was a kid listening to that on the radio growing up in Duluth, and he's been throwing in a couple of songs on each of the last couple of albums in that style, which is abysmal, I think. You know, it's not folk, it's not blues, it's not rock, it's not Dylan music, and he thinks he can sing it, although he cannot sing,
mm-hmm.
right? That's one of the things we love about him.
Yeah.
Used to be a powerful croak, is now a raspy wheeze. Above and beyond the fact that he can't sing, and the arrangements are awful, there is his delivery, Greg. You know, the chorus coos angelically. In the meadow, we can build a snowman, and then Bob comes in.
Until the other kids will knock him down.
And then the other kids will knock him down.
And it's like, he's like the horrible alcoholic black sheep of the family, come to Christmas dinner uninvited, who says all inappropriate things, knocks things over, breaks people's presents, pinches everybody's bums, right? And you just want to throw them out. And it's like, it is so inappropriate for Christmas. I know it's for charity. Make a donation to public radio or to any charity. Feel good about yourself. Save yourself the torture of listening to this album, which is truly one of the worst albums ever made. I'm talking like William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy doing those records in the 60s where they tried to be pop stars.
Yeah.
Those are less painful
yeah.
than this Dylan album. It is a double trash it.
You're making it sound almost entertaining, like in this it's so bad it's good category.
Oh, Lord, but no, I didn't mean to do that.
But it is a trash it.
I tell you, little buddy, this whole island is bewitched.
Just
remember? We were shipwrecked together.
Ah, yes, we love that introduction. It means that whenever possible here on Sound Opinions, either Greg or I like to take a trip to the proverbial desert island, pop a quarter in the jukebox, and play a song we cannot live without today. Mr. Cott, what have you got?
Well, Jim, reviewing Dylan's first ever Christmas album put me in the mood, a little prematurely perhaps for the holidays, but there are very few Christmas albums I actually like, and even fewer that I can play year-round. And the record I'm going to highlight today is one of those records that I truly believe.
You know it's October, right?
Yes, yes, indeed. But I'm playing this record with the full knowledge that it is premature, but at the same time, I believe it is a truly great record and a record that is withstands any season.
Well, that says something, because when you're talking about Christmas music, you have a canon, not of like 50 years, like rock and roll, but of like 4 or 5 centuries.
Right.
So it's really got to be good to measure up.
Absolutely. And I think this record does the trick. It's by Low. It was a little EP released in 1999 by this, coincidentally enough, from northern Minnesota, much like Mr. Dylan himself, a trio led by a couple, Alan Sparhawk and Mimi Parker. They are devout Christians. They don't make a big deal about it in their music, but it certainly seeps through. And again, in this record, you can hear the influence of that faith and that culture that they grew up in. More than any kind of religious message, I think what's behind this record is the sense of slow-paced deliberation and a sense of solitude, like it was created under a blanket of snow that informs their best music. I think this band has made a number of wonderful records, and I'll put this at the very top of the scale. The song I'm going to play is called Long Way Around the Sea, and it basically tells the biblical tale of the three magi coming to visit the baby Jesus when he was born in a manger in these most destitute circumstances in Bethlehem. And it's a beautiful story, and it gets to the essence of why we celebrate this holiday every year. It cuts away all the business about sleigh rides and Christmas trees and bows and gifts, and really gets down to the essence of who this person was and why do we celebrate this holiday. And it does it in just a beautiful manner. Not only the solitude that I was talking about, but there's sort of a hovering anxiety in the music as well that I think speaks to how do we observe this tradition? Do we really know what it means? And are we living up to its ideals today? It makes me think, and it's a beautiful piece of music by Low, A Long Way Around the Sea on Sound Opinions.
We've come so far, we've followed the star, hare and herd said, bring me word, take the sea.
That is Low, Long Way Around the Sea, Mr. Kott's Desert Island Jukebox pick. A fine one it is, Greg. And also a reminder that that area of the world is far from peaceful right now, a haunting thing. What do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, we're going to sample a little bit of the French invasion. Phoenix has had one of the great success stories of the year, and we had him in the studio for an interview and a live performance.
Looking forward to it. Meanwhile, for this week's show, Mary Gaffney recorded Ani DeFranco for us. The show was produced by our hardworking and devoted team of Jason Saldana and Robin Lynn. And our executive producer and fearless leader is Tori Southside Malatia, a man who knows the correct Latin pronunciation, and it ain't Adore a Moose.
On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic, so now it's time to hear what you have to say.
New messages.
Hey guys, this is Tim from Chicago. I wanted to bring up another weird instrument, and that's that thing that the 13th floor elevators used. You know, that thing that kind of goes like... which I believe to be a jug. Yeah, an electric jug. And I've also heard rumors that that is what they kept their marijuana stash in. You guys ever do another show like this? I want to know about that.
Hi guys, this is Rob in Chicago. Just got done listening to your Weird Instruments podcast, and I had my 5-month-old son on my lap, and he was being kind of fussy, and I didn't really know what to do. And then the Mercury Rev song came on with the singing saw, and within 30 seconds I looked down, and he was out cold asleep. So I just want to thank you for giving me another song to put on his iPod in the nursery that will go between Bach and Mozart. So thanks a lot.
Hey guys, John Allure from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, phoning about your Muse show. Look, you had me with the weird instrument stuff. I totally almost cried when I heard the Beck song. But your review of Muse, come on guys, this is a great, great band with great ambition. And, you know, and to slag them for not having a sense of humor, what, sense of humor like Queen had on Fat Bottom Girls? Give me a break. Sense of humor like Queen had on Ogre Battle? Give me a break. What are you talking about? I love them for quoting that band. They're a great and refreshing alternative to all of the sort of grunge stuff that you guys love. So for you guys to just dismiss it without any consideration is too much. There's many Americans in this country who love Muse, who appreciate a drummer like Dominic. We haven't heard anything like that in quite some time. And I totally disagree with your review. Thank you.
Hello, this is Simon Wobble from Pittsburgh, North Carolina.
I just wanted to say I love your review of Muse today. I could not agree more. I had an ex-girlfriend who just thought I was brainless and had no taste, because the closest thing I could get to enjoying Muse was listening to The Killers to drown them out. We are must be in the same wavelength here, because I really appreciated that. So you guys did good work. I love it.
No more messages.
To give us your opinion on Sound Opinions, call our hotline, 1-888-859-1800. We'll be back next week with Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media.
In the drawing room, a group of suspects gathered. The detective has solved the mystery.
Ladies and gentlemen, the butler did it.
You'll never catch me.
The butler darted to his getaway car. But what he didn't know is this is a Nissan sales event ad.
Wait, what?
And his car is no match for the detective's Nissan Rogue or its standard VC turbo engine. Save on one of your own at the Nissan Thrill of the Drive sales event.
Now get 0% APR financing for 36 months on select models. Availability is limited. For well-qualified buyers, 0% APR financing for 36 months available on new 2023 Altima, Rogue, and Pathfinder when financed through NMAC. Must take delivery from new dealer stock. 36 months financing at $2,778 per month per 1,000 financed. Actual down payment may vary, subject to residency restrictions and NMAC credit approval. Not all buyers qualified. Dealer contribution may affect actual price set by dealer. Contact dealer for details. Offer ends 2/28/23.